You've probably seen the abstract. The plan of the talk is relatively simple today. What I want to do is I want to present an approach to kind of first principles approach to describe in very general terms the structure of a physical description of nature. So, in other words, what I want to develop is basically a way to start from first principles and say, how can we describe nature? What are natural structures to do that? And I want to see how far we can get with this kind of very general line of argument. So as an kind of, let's say, illustrative example, I will pass through classical physics, and in the end, we'll have an encounter with quantum theory in that context. So I'll say much more about this later. Okay. If we want to describe nature, of course, well, we have well-developed theories, and in physics we have classical physics and we have quantum physics. What I want to do today is to try to forget most of that, where by forget I mean forget the concrete structures that we use to describe classical or quantum theories. And I want to really try to kind of start from zero and with rather general reasoning, see how can we get to some concrete mathematical structures and what we can say about their interpretation. Of course, when I say we start from zero, that's not really true. I mean, we need to take input from experience we have from, and in fact, from physics in particular. So what I want to do is I want to be guided in this enterprise by two main principles. The first principle is locality. So that implies that we do assume a certain weak notion of space-time. And what I mean more precisely by locality is that we will assume that a knowledge or control of the immediate spatial and temporal surroundings is sufficient to describe physics. Of course, the formulation is rather vague at this point, and part of the work will be to make that precise. The other main ingredient I want to take is operationalism. And by this I mean here that I don't want to think about physics or nature in a way that there's this reality out there and we just have to discover it, but in a way that what I want to describe is how we interact with the physics or with nature. And of course, this is motivated by the fact that while in classical physics, we can talk about, let's say, particles or fields that are just out there, and it doesn't matter if I look at them or not or whatever, that there's just a given objective reality out there in space-time. Whereas in quantum theory, it's much more subtle, and the relation between, let's say, measurements or observations that we can make and the structures that we use to describe them is much more indirect. So in response to that, I will take this guiding principle of operationalism.
Clarify the locality guiding principle, because I read it and it sounds like it's saying local physics is about local stuff. That That seems.
Yes. So the point here is that the emphasis on surroundings, spatial and temporal surroundings. But I'll make that more precise in a moment. So I hope they'll be happy with. Okay. So as I said, this idea of locality that I want to implement requires a certain notion of space-time already. So this is really an input that we are postulating here. So in particular, I want to think of space-time in the sense that I want to be able to talk about region of space-time, and then the region has a boundary, and that boundary is kind of the interface to the rest of the universe, in a sense. And so the space-time region where the arena for local physics that we want to describe, and this boundary will be a device where to encode the interaction with the rest of the universe. And this is obviously where locality already comes in by my saying that whatever happens in the rest of the universe, it's communicated to this region exclusively through this boundary. Okay, so this is a quite strong input, and that's one version of this locality.
Do you also have a notion of locality which says that it's possible to describe everything sort of locally in space-time? There are no holistic properties, so it's
yes.
sort of separable and only interacts through this local boundary. It's both of those.
So the separable, not exactly sure how you mean, but I would guess yes. I think in the process of refining this, I think the answer will be clear. So that's kind of coming from locality. Now, the operationalism, what do I mean by this here, or how do I want to implement this here? The way I want to implement this is that my interaction with this local physics in the space-time region is through something that I will call a probe. Okay, it's a rather generic name, but one could imagine that one has some kind of experimental setup there, some apparatus that one as an observer or experimenter can interact with. So this notion of probe here is meant to generically describe the interaction with this physics in this region through this apparatus or whatever that is. Okay. Again, I'll make these things successively more precise as I go along. So if it sounds a bit vague and unclear, then I hope that will be clarified soon. There's also a special probe here, and that's basically where I just don't put any apparatus or there's no experiment or whatever. There's just the fact that there's space-time, nothing else. I'll call this the null probe, just a name if you want. Okay. Now, another important ingredient here in order to have a sensible description of physics is what we need to be able to do is we need to be able to talk about joint experiments. That is, if we have an apparatus here and here and make both of the measurements that correspond to these, then this as a whole constitutes a new experiment, if you want, in this case, in the joint space-time region. So I shall assume here in this case that these are space-time regions that are adjacent to each other. And sigma here is this hypersurface where these two regions meet. Okay. So we need this operation of combining probes in adjacent space-time regions. And I'll just use this symbol to denote the composite probe. Okay. These hypersurfaces that appear everywhere here, as I said, will have the role of, or associated with this hypersurface, will have a notion of what I shall just generically call boundary conditions. And these, again, coming from locality, I shall assume that all the interaction or communication between these two probes will be through the boundary, where in this case, of course, there's a joint boundary here, and there's another component which is everywhere around. And if I fix boundary conditions on this on this larger on this outer boundary, then all the communication can only happen through this interior boundary. So that's, again, an assumption coming from this locality principle. Okay. And if you want, you can call this a kind of holography in the most basic sense. Okay, so let's make this a little more precise. Oh, sorry. Okay. mathematically, so okay, so for some given space time region, we have a set of probes, and I'll just call this PM. And in particular, one of the probes is this null probe. And we have a rule for adjacent spacetime region of composing probes, okay, which is what I was talking about before. So mathematically speaking, it's a map from this product to the space of probes in this joint region. Okay. Now, as I alluded to already, for each hypersurface, to each hypersurface, we associate a space of boundary conditions. Okay, the word, I'm not, okay, so the word boundary conditions is not ideal here, but it's the kind of best approximation I found to what is meant here. So what these boundary conditions encode is, as I said, are the possible physical information flows between the two regions which are adjacent to the hypersurface, okay. Okay, so now comes the key step to go to a quantitative description. Okay, so far everything was kind of qualitative. So the quantitative part comes in here. So, and that consists in the following. So we have a space-time region. We put a probe in the space-time region, and we fix a boundary condition. If we do all this, then we get a quantity which I chose to be a real number. So a real number in the tradition of physicists usually assuming that everything that can be measured is a real number or a bunch of real numbers, right? So this also clarifies a little bit of what these probes are. Okay, so if you think, so a probe isn't really an apparatus. A probe is like an apparatus where you have made settings and where you have determined exactly what quantity you want to read out, okay, which might be as a light switched on or off, or might be the a meter, what reading a meter shows. Okay, so a probe is all this together. Okay, that's a probe. So basically, I'll use this notation for this map. So M is the space-time region, so this is the space of probes, this is the space of boundary conditions, and that goes to the real numbers. Okay. So the kind of simplest case, what one could imagine what these quantities signify, could be the following. So these quantities could directly represent measurable quantities like the reading of a meter, and also predict these with certainty So being just a deterministic setting in that sense. Okay. So a special case of probes that's kind of important are probes that don't give just some real numbers, but give answers to yes-no questions. Okay, the kind of simplest measurements or observations one could imagine. And then it's convenient, of course, to represent these probes in such a way that the quantities associated to this are either 0 or 1. Okay, that's an arbitrary choice, but useful. Okay, so now I want to step back from this kind of abstract setting and go to an actual realization of this to illustrate this better. Yeah.
Just a question before you move on to an example. Are you imagining that the probes can interact with particular regions within M, I guess? Like, can it be... Or is it just
within? You mean with a smaller region that's inside?
Inside.
Yes, yes,
okay.
Yes. So so for example, if you have a probe in a certain region, then this would give you automatically also a probe in a larger region, which in which the smaller region is embedded. Yes. And you can think of that, in fact, as a kind of composition where the inner region and the outer could be around, and you would put the null probe there.
And are the probes allowed to measure properties of the boundary?
You could imagine special probes that are kind of sensitive directly at the boundary. Yeah. But the important point is that a probe is supposed to be insensitive to anything that's outside. I mean, in the sense that it's sensitive to anything on the outside only through information flow through the boundary.
There's one more question. So the space of probes associated with a particular region, are you imagining that must be built out of the space of probes associated with smaller parts of that region or not? Is it possible?
Not necessarily, no. Assuming that, no.
Okay.
It could be, so one could ask, for example, in this setting, all the probes that are in this joint region, do they arise in this way? I'm making no assumption to this effect.
How's that consistent with the locality assumption, though? I mean, if your probes on the composite region could not be decomposed into probes and component regions, would that not be a kind of violation of locality? And if not, why not?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a good question. It's an assumption that one could add without altering much of what I'm doing. So I'm just kind of not making that assumption. So for example, if you have an apparatus, think of this really as something in space-time, and I'm having some apparatus that's sitting here and occupying some space here around this hypersurface, and then might be difficult to cut that into two pieces so that it still works. So, of course, if these probes are really something fundamental, one could ask this question and one could think if one should implement some additional constraint of this type. But I haven't thought about that. So, in other words...
Doesn't entanglement mean you cannot do that? You cannot reduce...
Yeah, okay,
I mean,
so... I didn't want to talk about this yet, but
something like that.
So for the moment, I'm kind of behaving as if there was no entanglement. Later when I talk about probabilities and so on, it will be clear that I can, everything is compatible with entanglement. But at this stage, that's not so clear yet. Yeah. Maybe later we talk about this, where this is better suited.
And what are we to think of this combining operation means? Why should there be a unique way? I mean, if they're interacting with each other, there won't be a unique way. So are they just side by side without?
Yes. I mean, with the interaction here is, what you should think of this combination generically means just that you do both experiments. And it's the combination is not a physical operation. It's purely an operation of the description of the physics. It doesn't have any, that doesn't correspond to any action you take, any additional observation, nothing. It's just a composition of the description. Okay, so let's go to see how I will refine this scheme further and further, but before I do that, I want to give a first example to make this a bit more concrete. And that's why I want to talk about classical physics now. And of course, the ingredients I'm introducing now are beyond what I was telling you at the beginning, that I just want locality and operationalism. What I want to do now is give you structures that will fit into this framework. Okay, so these are all additional inputs now. Okay, just to make this clear. Okay, so let's say we have classical physics, and in space time. So in the space time region, in particular, while the classical physics is encoded in solutions of the equations of motion of our classical system, which would consist of field configurations and of particle trajectories. So locally, what do we have? We have two types of, we have the regions and we have the hypersurface. So for the regions, we have just the space, for each region, the space of solutions of the equations of motion in the region. And for the hypersurfaces, we have also a space of solution in a neighborhood of the hypersurface. And that's basically the same thing as saying initial data. For special types of hypersurfaces, this would be initial data. And then we have a map from the solutions in the interior to the solutions on the boundary that consists just in forgetting how the solutions look in the interior. Okay. So this is just a very generic picture of the basic ingredients of a classical theory in space-time. And then now, there's a notion of probe suggests itself in classical physics, which are just the observables thought in the standard way of just being functions, real-valued functions, on the space of solutions of the equations of motion. Where here, an important detail is that these are solutions inside a region. Okay, we're not talking about all of space-time. We don't have a notion of all of space-time, or not necessarily. Okay, so the observables, and that this fact that they are they live on this space of solutions in the given region mean that they are local, okay? Local to that region. Now, if we have two space-time regions with two observables, then we can take for the composition to be the product of the observables, okay? Product just in the sense that we multiply these functions, right? So if we have an observable here, then that extends naturally to observable on this combined region, and the same is true for the other one, and then we can just multiply them, and that would be a notion of composing probes, okay? One can imagine other ones, but I have chosen this composition for a reason, but in fact, it's not so important in this talk today, which type of composition we are considering. Yeah, I think that's fairly clear, and I hope. Okay, so but now let's look at these structures in this framework, how they can be in which sense the classical theory provides these structures. So the first thing is that the boundary condition on sigma can now be taken to be a boundary solution. So it's precisely a solution of the equations of motion in a neighborhood of the hypersurface. Okay, so something like initial data. Then for a spacetime region, we can define the null probe in the following way, namely as a detector for whether or not the solution, the solution on the boundary, there are two possibilities. Either that solution extends to a solution in the interior or it doesn't. Okay? Or in other words, there is a solution in the interior that reduces to the given boundary data, or there isn't. And we can just set it to 1 if there is and to 0 if there isn't. Okay. And to encode, so as I said, we can take the observers as probes. And basically, if there's a solution, so for a given boundary condition, if there's a solution in the interior that matches the boundary condition, it's the observable as a function evaluated on that solution, and otherwise we can set it to 0. Okay, so all this might look a little bit artificial, and in a sense it is, but what I want to give you is a kind of first feeling of what these probes and boundary conditions could be. Okay, some.
What was the difference between the first and second?
You mean this and this?
Yeah.
So this is the special case where the observer is the function with value 1. But it is it gives only 1 if there is this solution in the interior that matches the boundary solution.
Oh, I see. That's two different files.
Yeah, sorry. So this phi is the interior, and that's the boundary thing. And I'm secretly also assuming...
But what if there's more than one solution?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I'm secretly only also assuming that there's only one thing. That. So if you have a simple field theory, this will be true. In general, it might not be true, and then you would have to adapt the meaning of these things, especially if you have things like gauge transformations and so on. But this is not very relevant for my general argument, so I will just stick to this, to the simple case here, and assume that would be the case. Otherwise, one could also think of modifying the notion of observable to give the same value if there exists this ambiguity. But as I said, it's not very relevant to my to the general argument I'm trying to make. Okay, so let's now go back to this to the general framework, and see how we can develop this further. So for this end, I want to restrict my attention for the moment to probes that yield yes/no answers. Okay, so experiments that are kind of where the outcome is yes or no, in a sense. And a crucial thing about these probes is that they might maybe organize into hierarchies and give partial orders. Okay. So for example, let's consider an instrument that has one light, an apparatus with one light, which can either show red or green. Okay. And I want to consider three different probes associated to that. One is the probe that gives the quantity 1 if the light is red and 0 otherwise. One that gives the quantity 1 or two if the light is green and zero otherwise, and one with is always one when the instrument is present. So I don't even look at the light if it's green or red. Okay, so it's just the presence of the apparatus itself that's encoded in this probe here that I shall call P star. Okay, so it's a very simple case, and so the hierarchy I'm talking about here, and the partial order is simply the following: is namely this thing is more general than these two, and the partial order appears when we evaluate the probe with a boundary condition. So we put a boundary condition B on our region. And then we'll have that this probe that corresponds to the red light gives a quantity that's always smaller or equal to this one. And this gives a quantity also that's always smaller or equal to this one. Okay, because if this is 1, then this is 1. If this is 1, then this is 1. But if this is 0, this is still 1. Of course, this case looks kind of trivial. But when you have instruments or probes with more, or let's say instruments with more lights and switches and so on, then this really starts to be more interesting. Okay, so for example, if I have 2 lights, then I get this hierarchy of probes here. Okay, so it's kind of self-explanatory. In addition to just having this hierarchy, having the structure of small or equal, I also have certain summation relations. So for example, this probe and this probe is equal to this probe. And here, this is always evaluated with a boundary condition. But the point is, as in this picture, this is true for all possible boundary conditions. So we can think of, so this gives us an addition on the space of probes, okay. Okay. The probes might, in fact, not just correspond in a direct way to an outcome of a measurement or something like that, but they might just give us a probabilistic rather than deterministic prediction of a measurement. Okay. So in particular, the quantities associated to probes might be probabilities or expectation values, okay, real expectation values. And in fact, interesting quantities are often, or in fact, usual conditional probabilities or expectation values, but I'll come to that later. So again, I want to give you an example for this before I push this further. And the example is, again, classical physics, again, encoded in a very similar way, but now it's classical statistical physics, okay? So the boundary conditions are no longer classical solutions in the neighborhood of the boundary. They are now probability densities on the space of boundary solutions, okay? So one way would be to think of these as statistical ensembles of boundary solutions. Now we can introduce probes in a way very similar than as we did before in the classic case, with the difference that that what we do now is we integrate over this boundary solution space with this probability density that's our boundary condition, okay? So then, given a probe and a boundary condition, which now is this kind of is probability density, we can define the quantity that the probe gives as the integral over the So remember that the probes we use come from observables. So P is an observable. So it's a function on the space of solutions in the interior. So we integrate this function over over this distribution on the boundary, reduced, restricted to the solution that come from the interior. Okay, is that clear? Kind of what? Okay. So examples of physical quantities of interest are now, for example, if we look at the null probe, then what this null probe gives us now, if I assume that these distributions on the boundary are normalized, would be the fraction of the boundary probability distribution that's physically realizable. Where again, with physically realizable, I mean that come from a solution in the interior. Okay. And now if I want, if I'm interested in the expectation value of an observable, let's encode it in probe P, then this expectation value given a certain boundary condition is not directly PB, but it's PB divided by this fraction here, okay? So that's a first concrete example of a physical quantity that arises from a quotient of these objects, okay?
It seems to me these are not physical quantities in the same sense as your previous one. These are expectation values, so they're not things that can be measured by a single probe. You need an ensemble.
Yes, okay, so when I say physical quantities, I don't mean necessarily a quantity that you read off on your meter. I mean a quantity that you compare your meter with, but this comparison can be in a probabilistic sense. So it's like a, in that, I mean here that would be a prediction for yeah, the expected value of a quantity.
I don't even think it's, yes, this is the expected value of another quantity, but you're making this be itself.
So maybe the word physical quantity is not quite adequate here. Maybe that's what you say. And so yeah, it depends what you mean by physical quantity. So I use here wide meaning, and if you use a more narrow meaning in the sense that this is exactly the quantity that I read on my meter, then it's not. I agree. No. Okay, so now let's come back to the framework, and let me just see how. Okay. Okay, so let's talk more about these conditional quantities where this was a kind of first example. So suppose we are interested in the, or maybe before, no, maybe I should say something else before. Just going back quickly to these pictures. So this hierarchy makes perfect sense also in the probabilistic setting. Okay, I was saying before, okay, let's first consider the case that that we have the quantities that are directly corresponding to something that we measure. But also, if we are in this probabilistic setting, then this exactly same hierarchy applies, and we get this partial order on the space of probes, okay, in the same way. Okay, so now let's talk about conditional quantities. suppose we are interested in the expectation value of an observable encoded by a probe P given a specific boundary condition. Okay, here we make the assumption that not looking at the instrument is just equivalent to the null probe. Otherwise, we just put here the instrument without the determined light state. And this is just the quotient. Okay, so here, In this picture, I have kind of illustrated the boundary condition with a thermometer, okay? So One thing that could be a boundary condition is say, well, in my lab, the temperature is, I don't know, 20 degrees Celsius. Okay, so here we have the probe, and suppose it's the probe that tells us the light is green, and the temperature is 20 degrees, divided by the quantity that we get without looking at the light, and also saying that it's 20 degrees. So this has shown us that, in general, we need to. This thing here is not necessarily one, right? This denominator. That's why we have this this quotient here. Or we can also think about relative expectation values. So, for example, we have the instrument here. We have a fixed boundary condition, and what we want to know is that suppose that the left light on the instrument shows green, how probable is it that the light on the right-hand side will be green? And this will be exactly this quotient here, okay? And the boundary conditions themselves can also form hierarchies and encode it in partial orders. So, for example, again, nicely illustrated with the temperature here, let's say this boundary condition tells us that the temperature in the lab is between 10 and 20 degrees. And this one tells us it's between 10 and 15, and this that it's between 15 and 20. Okay. Then, of course, this is more general than this and also than this, and we have this partial order. And the partial order is really does correspond to a partial order once we put a probe there, right? And in fact, it doesn't matter what the probe is, we will always have these inequalities. So that means that this inequality is really a structure on this boundary, space of boundary conditions. The other thing that I didn't say clearly until now is that the moment we introduce the probabilities and so on, and we talk about admit expectation values, both the boundary conditions and the space of probes acquire the structure of a vector space, a real vector space, right? Because we can, if we have a probe that gives us an expectation value, we can, let's say, multiply with 2, and that would be another probe. Or we can add 2 probes, which just corresponds to adding the meter readings after reading them off or something like that. Okay. And so what we really have, I'll come back to that later. Okay, so another conditional probability that we can think of is even the case where we have another instrument in both cases, and we just compare different boundary conditions. Okay. So given a certain boundary condition, how probable is it that we'll have we are in a space of a certain sub-boundary condition, C. Okay. So here maybe a little not so intuitive to see what's the physical meaning of such a quantity, but in a sense, it is the information we're adding here is about the space-time region, M. Okay, so the presence of the space-time region. Okay, so the boundary conditions just live on the boundary hypersurface, and the fact that we add in the region allows us to make these kind of statements. Again, I'll say more about this in a more concrete case later.
At this point, are you assuming everything is classical?
No. No, I'm sorry. The structure of the talk isn't ideal. So what I'm kind of doing is I'm kind of changing between presenting the general framework and then giving an example from classical theory and classical statistical. But when I go back, I basically talk about the general framework
right. Again. So, okay. So, but then you said you could add 2 probes. I'm not sure. And suppose you're trying to add Q and P or something. There's no. It's not physically obvious.
So the addition is only with their probes in the same space-time region. And what I mean is that I just, I mean, the addition could just be consist of, I mean, reading 2 meters and adding the numbers.
So certain probes can be added.
It's true. Okay, so how shall I say that correctly? So it's not necessarily true that for every element in this vector space that I'm talking about, there's some concrete instrument. It's really the vector space that's generated by these instruments. Maybe that's a better. It's better to say that way.
But then there's going to be some equivalent to it. I mean, it seems not a priori.
So the addition that's clear that we have are these kinds of additions, okay? Here. Okay. But I haven't shown you that I could take an arbitrary probe and an arbitrary other probe and that the addition doesn't necessarily correspond to some actual apparatus. I agree, yeah. And that's something that one has to take into account.
I mean, the point is it might be generated, but it's not freely generated by these probes. There are going to be relations. Anyway.
See how. Okay, so let's talk more about the formalization of this. So what do we have? We have that the space of boundary conditions, that these are real vector spaces with a partial order. The probes also, first I talked about probes that I have outcome 0 or 1. In the probabilistic setting, these would be probes with an outcome between 0 and 1. So these give, when I combine them with boundary conditions, give rise to positive linear functions on the space of boundary conditions. I have a larger space of more general probes that give me more general expectation values, okay. Which is again a real vector space with a partial order. Okay, so you can think of this as generating the order in this larger space, or generating a positive cone in this larger space. There's another thing that I want to show you that emerges from this framework, which is the rule how, if you have two probes in two adjacent regions, how these combine. I'll go through this very quickly because there's not much time left. So if you want to have more details after the talk, I can tell you again about this. One thing is that if we have a hypersurface, the hypersurface gives rise to what I shall call a slice region. So we just think of doubling this hypersurface and taking an infinitely thin spacetime region, which as its boundary has two copies of this hypersurface. Okay, and I call this slice region. So the use of the slice region is that it shows us that on the space of boundary conditions, there exists an inner product. Okay. Namely, if we take the slice region and put one boundary condition on one side, one on the other, and then we evaluate this with a null probe in the slice region, we get a real number. Right? Now the locality tells us that different boundary conditions should encode different physics of adjacent regions. So that means that this inner product should be non-degenerate. Or in other words, if it was degenerate, then an element that would give zero always with whatever it's paired on the other side, or no, sorry, I should say that in a different way. If we have two elements that always give the same result, then they don't encode different physics. Okay, so that would be redundant. So we might assume this to be non-degenerate. So basically, the space can have positive and negative definite components. That means essentially that we can choose an orthonormal basis, which means a basis where between two vectors in the basis we have a Dirac delta, and that might be a factor of minus one if we're in the negative definite component. Okay. So, of course, if these spaces are infinite dimensional, there are more complications how this exactly works out. I'll ignore them for now. Okay. Now we can, since we have an inner product, we have a completeness relation, okay? And this is basically the completeness relation written out here. So here we just insert a complete basis into this inner product, and that's of course the same as taking the product directly between the outer boundary conditions B1, B2. And that has a geometric analog, which is the decomposition of this region in two slice regions that are identical. Okay. I think I'll not go through this in detail. Now, if we have two adjacent regions with probes, then since due to locality, there should exist a boundary condition on this intermediate boundary, I mean all other boundary conditions fixed, that encodes precisely the presence of this region with this probe and this boundary condition here. Let's call this little q. Okay. So that means, written as an equation, it's this one. This is the composed probe with the boundary conditions BC, and this is just the probe in M with the boundary condition B and Q. So the question is now, what is Q? And we can work that out easily because the Q encodes the presence of this region. So here I just wrote the inner product of the Q with some other arbitrary boundary condition B. So this must be equal to that because that's what the Q is supposed to encode. So it's equal to having this probe. The C is missing here. Yeah, slight mistake here. B and C boundary conditions. Now, we can just insert a decomposition of the B in terms of our basis. So mathematically, it looks like this. And that also has a geometric equivalent, which is that we present this as a gluing of the region N with a slice region sigma. Okay, so it corresponds to this identity. Now, If we look at this identity, we can read off what Q is, namely Q is this BK, the sum over the BKs with this weight and the minus one. So this is Q. Okay. So the important thing is this is really a derivation. I mean, on this slide, I'm not putting any additional ingredients here. Okay. The point is that this allows me to write the gluing of the probes in the adjacent space-time region in this way. Okay. So this is equal to the probe here with the basis element BK and BK here, and I sum over the complete orthonormal basis. Okay. So that means that we don't have just these spaces of boundary conditions, these spaces of probes in the space-time regions. We also have rules that these objects satisfy. In particular, we have this composition rule for these. Okay, so that's quite a lot of mathematical structure. Okay, so let me say something about the structure and the rules that we got. So we have the boundary conditions, we have the probes, we have a rule for the composition of probes in space-time, and I'll just highlight two interesting conditional probabilities here, or one on one side, a conditional probability for probes, where one is more general than the other and with a null region, and the other one being the expectation value of a probe given a boundary condition, okay, given by this quotient as we've seen. So the surprise is now the following. Okay, these structures and rules are the structures and rules of quantum theory. Okay. The boundary conditions generalize mixed states. The probes generalize observables and quantum operations. The probe composition rule in space-time, in fact, arises from the Feynman path integral. This conditional probability, the standard transition amplitude in quantum theory, is exactly a special case of this object. And the expectation value of an observable in standard quantum theory is a special case of this object. Okay. Okay, so for you to believe this to me, I have to explain this in more detail, of course. So, yeah, I said of quantum theory, well, I'm talking about a particular formulation of quantum theory, which emerges from a constructive approach where you really start with standard quantum theory and develop all the way there. And that's what's called the general boundary formulation of quantum theory, and in particular in the special form of what I call the positive formalism. And this is exactly what I talked about last time here, which was in February 2013. So if you've been to that talk, then you've seen this picture before, for example, and some of the others too, just with a slightly different notation. Okay. So obviously, I will not have time to tell you how to go the other way and arrive at exactly the same structures. So let me just make some closing remarks on this. So one thing is that we have seen that we can describe both classical and quantum physics here. So for the classical physics, I gave you examples. For the quantum physics, I just told you that it's exactly that, which you could read up in my paper. So one question is obviously, how can we characterize the difference between classical and quantum in this context? So in the classical statistical case, which is the case of interest to compare, the boundary conditions are essentially real-valued functions on a set. I mean, they are these probability densities, which are essentially real-valued functions. And the positivity is just the positivity of functions. So mathematically speaking, this the space that they form is it's a lattice. It's what's called a lattice. In the quantum case, the boundary conditions are essentially self-adjoint operators on a Hilbert space. Okay, this is what I didn't tell you, but what and in particular, these spaces form what's called an anti-lattice. Okay. So in a sense, they're as far away from this case as possible. Unfortunately, I don't have time to explain this further. Anyway, I don't have much more explanation to offer. This is really an open question. So, I mean, is that really the main difference between the classical and quantum case? Are there other differences? What is the physical significance of this difference? Okay, so just some closing general remarks. So as you might have noticed, this notion of space-time that I was using does not really require talking about time specifically or about causality. So this suggests the framework to be suitable in the classical case, for example, as a basis for a statistical theory of gender relativity, which kind of the first starting point could be what I told you about, what are the boundary conditions in a statistical classical theory and so on. In the quantum case, as a basis for a quantum theory of gravity, and of course, if you've seen me talk before, then this is the main motivation for the program, which is really behind this version of quantum theory, which I couldn't tell you about today. Another thing about this fact that this framework seems to admit both classical and quantum theories, it could perhaps be useful for constructing hybrid theories that combine classical and quantum parts. Yeah. Of course, there are lots of questions now related to all this, and it's very fresh, but I'll stop here. Thanks.
So I'm pursuing a statistical version of general relativity. And so
yes.
There's a lot of things in common with the program that you're laying out. One thing that's different is the question of if you talk about general boundaries or boundaries or regions from an operational point of view, then you need to give operational significance to that concept also. And that seems to be something that you don't have in your framework at this stage. The boundaries are more of a mathematical feature.
It's been quite
a struggle to get that aspect.
Yes, so here this would be only through these probes. Mm-hmm. So for example, you could... there was a question about the boundary and probes. So you could think about particular probes that are kind of just sensitive to things that happen on the boundary. and try to do something with that. But at this stage, there's no further structure to that. It's just there's no manifest notion of this here. But a further remark about this. So this, coming from the other direction, from the general boundary formulation, there are two formalisms. There's one that deals with amplitudes, and that deals with the quantities that appear here directly. And in the version with amplitudes, which is more directly related to the path integral and so on, there also these boundary observables play an important role in quantum field theory. In particular, you can use them to deduce the canonical commutation relations in quantum field theory. Okay.
And then another remark is that the sort of what you're calling the positive formulation has a lot of similarity with work that I've done and work that Giulio Chirivella and Mara Doriano and Pavinotti have done on giving a formulation of sort of the quantum theory of circuits, using objects which are linear in probability.
Right.
And even indeed going back to my causaloid framework, which did that also. So that sort of idea of using objects which are linear in probability in some sense.
Yes, it's exactly in the same line, yeah.
And then the final remark is your locality condition starts to look a lot like the local tomography condition. I'm not sure if it's the same, but I get strong sense that it's doing.
Yeah, I don't know much about what this.
That's the condition in which you can join operations in these operational these general operational frameworks.
Yeah, in fact, one reason for giving this talk is to understand how that connects with ideas that have been around recently in, or even for a long time in the foundations community.
When you talk about this completeness relation, are we supposed to understand that in the same, in the case, in the quantum field theory case, are we supposed to understand that as the Hilbert space completeness?
No, okay, so...
Because...
Yeah, okay, let me say one thing about this. So coming back to this point that for this general boundary formulation, there are these two versions. One is what I call the amplitude formalism, which is directly related to the path integral, and where this composition is exactly basically what you're saying is the completeness in the interfacing Hilbert space. Now, in the positive formalism, you could say it's the completeness in the corresponding space of mixed states, or better in the space of self-adjoint operators on the Hilbert space.
Okay, some derived Hilbert space.
Yeah.
In that case.
Yeah, it's there are some details about
using a so-called Schmidt-Norman.
Yeah. So it would correspond to the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product exactly.
Huh. Okay. So what worries me is that normally you think that you can define at least formally elements of Hilbert space on a Cauchy surface. But you don't think you can define them on, for example, time-like surfaces. But this is supposed to be independent of any choice of metric, I think. That's what you told us. So are there technical issues?
There are technical issues,
in defining
issues, yes.
This kind of
yeah. So let me first say...
The boundary is not space-like.
Yeah, okay, so first, there's on the one hand, there's this kind of general framework I was talking about today, and on the other hand, of course, looking at a particular theory or even a class of theories, the question is how do you get these objects? I mean, how do you construct them? And there are indeed technical problems. So for example, going to this here, where you want to, in this amplitude formalism, what you want to construct is things like Hilbert space. So you can do that certain time-like hypersurfaces, and well, there's literature going back to almost 10 years with simple examples. But the kind of general problem of is very much the general problem of quantization in this context, which is not closed, it's not a closed subject, and not.
You could have, since you don't, you've told us nothing about the metric. You could have your boundary could be space-like in parts, time-like in parts, null in parts.
Yeah. Okay. So.
This inner product.
Okay. So.
Independently, without knowing which parts are null, which parts are space-like.
Yes. So the framework as such is agnostic to that, and so you can, the minimal ingredients are, from a space-time point of view, are just these kind of topological manifolds, the minimal ingredient. But if you say what I want to model, and I want to consider a concrete physical theory, and this theory comes with a metric background, then you can put that on top without affecting the interpretation of the objects. But of course you have to construct them, and then you need a quantization scheme, for example, to construct these objects, and then there might be obstructions. And in fact, the question, for example, in quantum field theory, what should such a Hilbert space, or in general, it's a Quine space, in fact, what should that be on in a given theory, on a given hypersurface? So that's not a question that has a settled answer in general. It has, if you have a space-like hypersurface, and then it's more or less worked out in the literature on quantum field theory and curved space-time, right? But in general, it's a difficult question, and there are issues of a technical nature in general. So there are examples where this is solved and worked out, but not in a general sense that you could say, oh, this is solved for all of quantum field theory. No.
But probably it's not even solved for the simplest quantum field theory. If you demand the boundary to be an arbitrary.
Yeah, that's true. If you want this, so in general, it's easier if you have a kind of very restricted geometry of your hypersurfaces too. And then you can do that for a class of theories, say.
So I guess I'm feeling skeptical that you can really do set this up without having some sort of metric explicitly in the story.
No, you can, so for example, so
in the
so
case of gravity, it's even worse because all you would have really, the only covariant thing you could talk about would be sort of the topology of the region R.
Or the differential structure, yeah.
And nothing more.
Right. Yeah, I'm not saying this gives you a recipe to go to quantum gravity. Okay. So at the moment, this is a general framework. And of course, the first thing you want to do to check if this makes sense, what is exactly to go to quantum field theory. And a lot has been done there. But it's not, that's not closed yet. So the most progress, I should say, has been done in the case of fermions, in fermionic field theory. It's not on this slide yet, but so there you can show that this works in a very general setting, and the problem of general hypersurfaces is much less serious there. Later I can talk to you about the technical reasons why and how the problem is solved there, at least partially. But that's very much at the frontier now of this problem.
When you say an emergent notion of time, why don't you say an emergent notion of space? You have a space-time, but you haven't given a metric of it. That means neither spatial distance nor
I can tell you later what I mean by this. As I said, this slide is really just an extra here. It's a very intriguing thing, but I can tell you about this afterwards if you like. It doesn't come from the metric. That's the interesting thing about
it. It's not time. Then it's not the right time.
It coincides with the right time when the right time makes sense. But it's something that's quite open as well. It's not. It's just something intriguing that's there to be looked at. It's not. Again, this doesn't have to do much with my talk today.
Okay, thank you very much.